Well, good evening and welcome to the second presentation in this, our 13th series of talks on faraway places with strange sounding names, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries. My name is Brian Kutz, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services at WKU, I coordinate this series with my colleague in the white, Peggy Wright, and with help from our webmaster here taking pictures, Haiwan Wan. Daniel Peach and Christopher McConnell designed our posters, and our technical specialist tonight is Terry Perkins. Our speaker tonight is a native of Minnesota, where he grew up in a farming family. He was influenced by stories of faraway places and faraway times and wanted to be an archaeologist. And while attending high school in Lake Forest, Minnesota, he became interested in Buddhism. At the Universities of Minnesota and Wisconsin, he studied anthropology and South Asian studies. And in 2004, he received a PhD in Buddhist studies from the University of Michigan. He's an assistant professor of religious studies at the University of Louisville, where he teaches classes on Asian religions with a focus on Theravada Buddhism and Burma. His travel and research have taken him to northern India and Burma, and he speaks Hindi and Burmese languages. He's affiliated with the Buddhist Academy Thitagukava Buddha Thakatol in Sagang, Burma. I've been practicing, where he has served as an instructor and translator. His research interests include Burmese Buddhist monastic history and historiography, Sangha-state relations, Buddhist scholasticism, and Burmese popular religion. His interests in North India include village Hinduism, pilgrimage, and the geography of sacred sites. And in the U.S., he examines immigrant Buddhism and the dynamics of integration. His articles have appeared in Buddhism in Practice, the Encyclopedia of Buddhism, and the Journal of Burma Studies. The theme of tonight's talk is Paths to Liberation in Burmese Buddhism. Please welcome Patrick Pranke. Patrick.
Thank you very much for that introduction. Paths to Liberation in Burmese Buddhism. I will read a little bit from my prepared piece here, and then I will be ad-libbing quite a bit on the last part. And I would like to do this like I do a lecture. And so if there are any questions during my presentation that you'd like clarified or want to comment on, please do raise your hand, and I'll be happy to entertain questions and let the presentation take that course. The modern state of Burma, also known as Myanmar, is geographically the largest and westernmost country of mainland Southeast Asia. We have it right here. Its population of approximately 50 million is comprised of more than 100 nationalities, the largest of which include majority Bama, or ethnic Burmans, the Rakhine, the Shan, the Kayin, and the Mon, amongst others. As a convention in English, members of all these nationalities receive the designation Burmese as citizens of the country. The vast majority of the Burmese people, regardless of their ethnic affiliation, subscribe to Theravada Buddhism as their traditional faith. So pervasive is the influence of this religion on the people of Burma that it is often said nowadays that to be Burmese is to be Buddhist. Indeed, historically it was Theravada Buddhism more than any other force that drew the many peoples of Burma together into a single civilization. So much so that even non-Buddhist citizens of the country acknowledge the centrality of Theravada ethical, social, and political conceptions to the fabric of Burmese life. The Burmese share their Theravada Buddhism with the neighboring Southeast Asian countries of Thailand, Laos, and Cambodia, and with the South Asian country of Sri Lanka. The commonalities that this religion has brought to all these countries over the centuries, they can be seen as members of a single generalized Theravada civilization, each country representing a unique permutation within that broader cultural sphere. Theravada, which means teachings of the elders, is an ancient form of Buddhism, one of the so-called 18 schools that emerged a century or so after the death of the Buddha, an event which the Theravada dates to 544 BCE. And the only one of these early schools to survive into the present. It contrasts in its beliefs and practices with the somewhat later form of Buddhism called Mahayana, or the Great Vehicle. The Mahayana, which encompasses a wide variety of traditions, historically has been the dominant form of Buddhism in China, Tibet, Korea, Japan, and Vietnam. When speaking of Buddhism generally in this talk, I'll be referring to the Burmese style of Theravada Buddhism. Buddhism very explicitly is a religion of salvation or liberation. And like all salvation religions, it sees the human condition as a predicament, as in a state of crisis in need of remedy. The predicament for humans, and from the Buddhist perspective, all living beings, that they find themselves in is called samsara, the cycle of birth and death, an endless round of suffering without beginning or end. The remedy for the predicament of samsara in Buddhism is nibbana. You know that word more as nirvana, probably. A term that literally means blowing out and refers to the extinction of suffering achieved by escaping from or putting an end to the cycle of rebirth. So how does one achieve this freedom from the cycle of rebirth and from suffering? Well, this requires that one first know its cause. According to the story of the Buddha recorded in ancient texts, he attained enlightenment while seated beneath a tree in North India by realizing four truths, the famous Four Noble Truths. The truth of suffering. Life is suffering. Existence is suffering. Suffering is pervasive. It can't be escaped from. Even happiness is suffering. Number two, the cause of suffering. The cause of suffering, according to Buddhism, is desire. And it is a particular kind of desire. It's called tanha in Pali. Pali is the sacred language of the Theravada tradition. It's not any old desire. It's desire that is called tanha. Tanha literally means thirst, like animal thirst. It's a technical term they use for desire. It is desire that is motivated by ignorance. Ignorance about the truth. It is desire that seeks out things that aren't real, things that are harmful. Desires that are good, desire to help someone, desire to be compassionate and so on, is a different kind of desire. The cause of suffering in this case is desire motivated by ignorance, tanha. And incidentally, it's important to know in the case of Buddhism that karma is defined in Buddhism as intention, as any kind of desire. Karma is any kind of intention and any kind of intentional action. So this desire, which is the cause of suffering, is karma itself. And suffering itself is none other than samsara, the cycle of birth and death. So we have to understand, when we're trying to understand Buddhist metaphysics, that karma is the fuel that keeps the cycle of birth and death going, and it is desire that is that fuel. So karma equals desire. The third noble truth that he discovered was the end of suffering. And that is equated with nirvana. And the end of suffering happens with the end of desire. When you eliminate desire, you eliminate suffering. When you eliminate desire, the cycle of birth and death comes to an end. And finally, he realized the path to the end of suffering. And that's the famous Eightfold Path. I won't give you the details of the Eightfold Path here, but the Eightfold Path is often summarized into three divisions that are easy to remember. And they're sort of stepwise in their presentation. There's a logical sequence. Starting at the bottom as the foundation is what we would call a morality. It's called sila. Sila is morality. And sila also means precepts, taking vows to refrain from bad behavior. So that's considered the foundation of the path leading to the end of suffering. And then on top of that, you have meditation. And the word that they use here for this is samadhi. Samadhi means concentration. So mental concentration through a meditation exercise to bring the mind to a calm state, to make it clear and limpid. Instead of like muddy water, you let the water settle so that you can see the bottom of the stream when it's very clear and calm. So meditation. And then finally, on the basis of the foundation of ethical living and meditation, you finally have wisdom. And this is liberating wisdom. Wisdom that allows us to escape from the cycle of birth and death. Buddhism is a Gnostic religion. Gnostic in the sense that it requires gnosis. It requires direct intuition to the truth, something beyond intellection, something that's a direct perception of reality. And that is what is meant by wisdom. And it's this direct intuition of reality which undermines craving. So wisdom, and that's called panya. So sila, samadhi, panya is basically what the Buddhist path is. Now wisdom is the capstone of this system because desire, the cause of suffering, has as its foundation ignorance. Ignorance of the way things really are. And ignorance can only be allayed and can be only put aside with liberating knowledge. And so what is realized in Buddhist realization? What is realized in Buddhist enlightenment? And what is realized is called the three marks of existence. So the three marks, the first mark, the one that is easiest to perceive, is impermanence. So we all know things are impermanent. Impermanent on a large scale, mountains erode through the force of water, people get old and die, furniture breaks and falls away. Everything is impermanent. And impermanent also at the sort of microscopic or atomic level. Everything arises and passes away momentarily, according to Buddhism. So impermanent are things that any perception of continuity through space and time is an illusion. For example, you see and I perceive and I feel that I'm walking back and forth in front of you. But really, according to Buddhism, what's happening is there is no movement through space or time. There is simply the arising and passing away of form on a momentary basis. A complete disintegration of this body every moment, replaced in a causal sequence with another body in its place, giving the impression of continuous movement of a solid body through time. And Buddhists had a hard time explaining that concept to Westerners until in the 19th century, the invention of the movie. So what do we see in a movie? We see Brad Pitt, you know, as Achilles on this big screen. And we're not really seeing Achilles. We see Brad Pitt. So we put that aside and, oh, it's Achilles. But we really don't see Brad Pitt either. We see light. We, of course, see Brad Pitt's head is really big. We know people's heads aren't that big. But we let ourselves be taken into the story. We put aside all kinds of doubt about the film so that we can see it. And yet we don't even see this drama going on, we apparently see, because that's not what's happening, it's flashes of light. Perhaps an eagle or some species that has really sharp vision can see simply the flashings. And so there's no Brad Pitt there either. And so Buddhism is going to say that, assert that life itself is like that. We perceive things passing through time. I perceive myself and my mind and my body as having got up this morning, as having come here, driven here, and will drive back, as at the end of the month I'm going to get paid because I worked all month and I better get paid. But upon Buddhist analysis, there is no path here. There is nothing that passes through time. And everything being impermanent also means that it's suffering. And what do they mean by suffering? Suffering in Pali is dukkha. And dukkha, I'll give you the word here, dukkha, because it's an interesting word. The folk etymology for dukkha is du means bad, ka means the hole in which an axle will be put. And it's not greased, and so it squeaks, like when you scratch a blackboard, dukkha. So that's dukkha. So it means suffering, it means literal pain, like when you're sick or when you're dying or you're decrepit. But it also means unreliability and insubstantiality. Things that are impermanent, so impermanent that when you reach out and touch them, they're really not there. They're unreliable. And yet we seek them because we think they are reliable. And then impermanence and suffering lead to the final, logically, category non-self. As I mentioned before, I think myself to exist through time. That's one of the presuppositions of selfhood. That's, it's enduring, it's solid, it's independent. But upon Buddhist analysis, when we look through Buddhist meditation and so on, we find that there's nothing there that exists through time and nothing that's reliable or substantial. Also, with non-self, it means that I'm not a master of anything. When we take something that we like, even pleasurable things, after a time, they will pass away. If I sit comfortably in a chair, for example, I saw this in a film, it was a very good analogy, sitting comfortably in a chair for a while. For a while, I'm comfortable, but after 24 hours, I might start feeling uncomfortable. So that which was pleasurable is now painful. And after 20 years, I'll be decrepit, and the chair will be decrepit as well. And so that which is pleasurable becomes suffering because it's always changing. It can't stay the same. But I wish it would stay the same. But I can't stop it. No matter how much I try, I can't keep things from passing away. Well, we have our brand new car, and we really love our car. And then somebody smashes into it, and then we feel suffering. Right? Because we haven't paid for the whole thing yet. You know? And, you know, so that's suffering. We cannot stop suffering. And in the most existential sense, we all want to live forever. We don't want to get old. But we get old. We can't stop it. In any real sense, we have no control over anything. Not anything we own. Not even this mind and body. It's passing away. We want to be happy. We're happy one moment, and it turns into sadness. We can't stop that. So the basic definitions of what a self is, that it passes through time and it's a master of its own destiny, that it is autonomous like we really feel we are, upon analysis we find nothing there. It's just an idea, a thought. with no referent. What we find instead is this mass of things, this rising and passing way of impersonal phenomena that are suffering and impermanent and not worth searching after. And yet we're always searching after, and we're always being afraid of things. The Buddhists would summarize the predicament of the human condition and the condition of all sentient beings in the following way. First of all, they'll say that this kind of ignorance about the way things are gives rise to three poisons, three bad things in our consciousness. First of all, desire. Remember that desire that I call tanha? Desire that's based on ignorance about the way things really are. So we're always running after things that we think will satisfy us when ultimately they can't, because they don't even exist. They don't exist the way we want them to exist. Hatred, which is just the flip side of desire. It's just the same thing, really. We're always running away from things that we don't like. And then upon analysis of ourselves, we can't even find ourselves. So this is basic ignorance. These are the three poisons: desire, hatred, all of which are based on ignorance. And so they would say the following about this situation. We are constantly running after and running away from things that really do not exist in order to satisfy and protect a self that likewise really does not exist. Can there be a more absurd predicament to be stuck in? They would ask. And the answer is no, they would say. There is no more absurd predicament. And the solution to this predicament is to let go, is to stop desire, stop hatred, stop running after and running away from things that really do not exist in order to satisfy and protect the self that really does not exist. When you realize there's nothing there, desire and hatred disappear. It's the condition. So without desire, when ignorance is replaced with wisdom, with panya, desire and hatred dissipate by themselves. You can't wish away desire. You can only know your way out of it through knowledge, through gnosis. And with no more desire, desire being karma, there's no fuel for samsara, the cycle of birth and death. That's liberation. That's nirvana. That's freedom. So that's basically, in a very sort of nutshell, the metaphysics and the salvation system that they're interested in. Now, the perfectly liberated person is called an arhant. And you'll hear that a lot in Burma. Arhant, so-and-so is an arhant, so-and-so is an arhant. And a perfectly liberated person is called an arhant. It literally means worthy one, worthy to receive gifts, by the way. So it's a person whom, if you give gifts, you'll get a lot of benefits from that. So worthy one. And all Buddhas are arhats, as are all their liberated disciples. All have lived their final lives. All have done what has to be done. And when they die, they will never be reborn again in the cycle of birth and death. That's nibbana. Nibbana means blowing out of suffering, blowing out of samsaric existence. But it's not easy to put the Buddhist teachings into practice, and it's not easy in the end to let go, especially when confronted with such an austere ultimate goal. The ultimate goal is rather austere, isn't it? It's the end of phenomenal existence. They don't say anything more. It's the coming to an end of suffering. It is coming to an end of phenomenal existence, period. So that's an austere goal. It's a daunting ultimate truth. So knowing this, the Buddha devised different paths for different kinds of people, all of which lead to the same ultimate goal, arhantship and nibbana, although they take different courses and they have different trajectories. We find this in the classical tradition. We find this in the ancient scriptures, which go back 2,000 plus years ago. And in turning to Burma, I'll talk about what I see as three such alternative paths to ultimate liberation from samsara that are operative in the Burmese Buddhist tradition today. So by way of introduction. Now the first path is what I would call the path of merit-making, which is dedicated not to the attainment of arhantship or nirvana, at least not in the immediate future, but dedicated to the attainment of happy rebirth in samsara. Most Buddhists don't want to attain nibbana. They want happy rebirth in samsara. Most Buddhists are happy in samsara, and they want to be reborn. That's the first path. This is a traditional path. It is the most common path, and both laypersons and Buddhist monks and nuns, for the most part, are following this particular path. And it turns out to be perfectly orthodox, because the Buddha made an avenue for that. The second path is the path of insight meditation. And insight meditation is a particular kind of meditation that the Buddhists claim is exclusive to them. They recognize the yoga practices are very profound and powerful in Hinduism and in other traditions. And in fact, the Buddha himself, while he was training to be a Buddha, learned meditation from Hindu yogis, very important meditative trance states. He was studied under Hindu yogis. But Buddhist meditation, this insight meditation, is unique and was discovered by the Buddha himself, so the Buddhists are going to say. And it's insight meditation which allows you to see into the three marks of existence and so attain liberation, which is the key. And so the path of insight meditation is also an option in Burmese Buddhism, and there are people who are dedicated to attaining nirvana or attempting to attain nirvana in this life or in the not too distant life through the practice of insight meditation. And the word insight is this interesting word. It's called vipassana, and it's made up of two parts. Passana means the verb to see. Vi means discriminatively. So insight is a very nice translation for it. It's a perfect translation by coincidence. Vipassana, insight, seeing into the nature of things, seeing the three marks of existence. The path of insight meditation leads to liberation in this life or in a very near life. And the third path is a path that's not discussed much in the West, but it's prominent in Burma, is the path of the Buddhist wizard. So what's a Buddhist wizard? A Buddhist wizard is a powerful thaumaturge. He's an alchemist, a magician. And his path is dedicated to not escaping this cycle of birth and death and not being reborn in the cycle of birth and death, but attaining virtual immortality in samsara and never dying. It's the Buddhist path of eternal life in samsara. So this is the third path. Now of these three paths, merit making and insight meditation we could call orthodox or normative. They come directly out of Buddhist scripture. They are affirmed and lauded by the Buddhist religious establishment, by the hierarchy of monks and so on, by the Ministry of Religious Affairs at Gabae, the capital religious center in Rangoon. Whereas the path of the Buddhist wizard is on the periphery of Buddhist orthodoxy. It's looked upon with certain suspicion by the religious establishment, sometimes accused of being unorthodox itself, and sometimes under pressure, at times, especially during the junta, during the time of the junta, occasionally put under scrutiny and harassment. So these three paths of liberation I would like to talk about. Now, first of all, these are all paths ultimately to Nibbana. The path of merit-making is postponing Nibbana until the far distant future. Traditionally, it has been thought that you will attain liberation with the coming of the next Buddha many, many millions of years from now. So in Theravada Buddhism, there's not simply one Buddha. We have the historical Buddha. He was simply one of an infinite number of Buddhas stretching into the past, infinite number of Buddhas stretching into the future. We know the name of the next Buddha. His name is Maitreya or Maitreya. You'll come many millions of years from now. So those who are practicing the path of merit-making, knowing that nirvana is the highest good, because the Buddha said so, and he wouldn't lie because he was a nice guy, he was omniscient, he would know. And we know it's the highest good, but it's kind of like St. Augustine, who said, paraphrasing, "O Lord, make me chaste, but not just yet." So the path of merit-making has that spirit. And when you talk to people who are, they're typically lay people, but also monks and nuns, they'll say, "I don't have the strength yet to wish for Nibbana because I have to give up so much to do that. I know it's the highest good, but I'm not ready yet. So what I'll do is I'll practice merit, good deeds, and then I'll have a happy rebirth. The next time I'll be wealthier, and then I can give more to the religion. I can be more charitable to the poor and so on, and gradually I'll reach a state to where some of these people whom I see around me today who can practice the path of liberation through insight meditation, I'll be ready like them. I'll have the strength of character to do that. But I'm too attached to my family and to my children and to my car and things. I can't do it this time. But I will help others achieve that goal because I respect them very much." So that's the attitude that you will encounter a great deal. Path of insight meditation, I have reached that stage that I really want to escape this endless cycle of birth and death. After all, I've been around forever. I have been everything. I've been male and female, human, I've been a cat, I've been a fish, I've been a god in heaven, I've been a denizen of hell, I've been a hungry ghost, I've been everything countless times. I've done every good thing possible, I've done every evil thing possible, I've been everything. The only thing that I haven't achieved is enlightenment and liberation. It's time. So that's their attitude. And the path of the Buddhist wizard sets himself a bit apart. And I'll talk about him a little later when I get to describing that in more detail. A little bit more detail about the path of merit making right now. It is the most common. It is the most also significant. Significant culturally in terms of civilization, because the path of merit making has to do with social relations and with the cement that binds people together. And it was the cement that helped create Buddhist civilization in Burma and throughout the Southeast Asian world. They have this sort of cosmopolitan common identity. And it was the path of merit making, doing good deeds, that is at the foundation of that. And there's no intention at that of attaining liberation next life or this life. It's the goal is to have liberation far away after enjoying many happy rebirths as a god, as a wealthy person, and so on and so forth. So we have, as I mentioned before, sila, or ethics, as the foundation of the religion. So typically for lay people, there are five precepts that you take. Not to kill human beings in particular. Not to steal, number two. Not to lie or misuse words, harsh talk, frivolous talk, backbiting, and so on. Not to engage in sexual misconduct, which means having sex with somebody else's spouse. That's what the scriptures say. They define it as having sex with somebody else's spouse in particular. And then avoiding intoxicants, because intoxicants can lead you to violate the other four. So these are the five precepts of lay people. And I mentioned that karma is intention, right? And so that has a role to play in the observance of sila, of the observance of the five precepts that I just mentioned. Because it's meritorious for you to observe these restraints and to be a good person that way. But if you add on top of that very intentional action, and you do that by taking the five precepts as a vow, you take, I vow today to observe the five precepts, and it's typically given on a daily basis. You either go before a monk, or you go to your parents, the parents can administer it, or you go to a Buddha statue, or just in your own mind, I take the five precepts. And so there's a little ceremony that you do, the little recitation. And then, because you've made a vow, and if on that day you manage to not break any of those precepts, then you earn a lot of merit. And merit is the key. Merit and demerit. Merit is stuff that comes off of good action, good karma. You get a merit store. It's like a storehouse in your consciousness. And the more merit you have, the better your rebirth is going to be. Some good karma, some ethical action, good or bad, has its retribution immediately in this life. You insult somebody and they smack you in the face. Immediate retribution, right? Some retribution happens later on in life. Some retribution happens in the immediate next life. And some retribution is indeterminate on when it's going to ripen. Merit is conceived of like a seed that you place in your consciousness from an action, and then it sprouts when the conditions are right, either in this life or in a future life. So if you are doing it intentionally, the seed is stronger. And it also means that if you have taken the five precepts and you break one of those, it's a lot worse, okay? Because the demerit is greater then, because you have broken an intentional action. Now, how does this apply to Buddhist armies? You have the precept not to kill. And Buddhist armies, just like Christian armies and Muslim armies and armies all over the world, if they have religion, they'll go to the priest or the minister and so on, and they'll seek a blessing. And what the soldiers do, and they do this today as well, regardless of which side of the political spectrum they're on, they will take the precepts. They'll take four. If they have to go into battle, they'll take four. They will not take the precept not to kill. It's harmful to kill. It's demeritorious to kill. They're ordered by their commanders. They're doing it for their country or in defense of something righteous. It's still unmeritorious to kill, but if you were to have taken that vow and then killed, it would be really, really bad. Also, I have friends who like to drink, and so they don't take on a particular day that they know they're going to be partying. They don't take the vow not to, to avoid intoxicants. It's a very practical religion. So, sila, meritorious acts. Now, lay people typically take five. We have a Buddhist Sabbath. It's every fortnight. Lay people can take more precepts at that time, and they will observe that for a period of time, and then they'll be released from the vow, and they earn even more merit by being more restrained. Monks, we have the Sangha, the word for the monastic community established by the Buddha. It's the oldest continuous institution in the world. The Sangha, the community of monks, they used to have nuns. The nuns' ordination died out. Monks take 227 rules. Now, they have to observe those all the time. Now, 227 rules, they govern every aspect of your life. How you brush your teeth, your deportment, how you speak to people, how you sit, how you apologize when you made a mistake, and so on and so forth. Your relations with lay people, your relations with women, your relations with men, and so on. There's lots of rules. It's impossible to observe all those rules. But in their case, the 227 rules, plus there's a lot of footnotes to those, adding more rules, is like a meditation. So someone who is attempting to observe the monastic rules as best he can is practicing a meditation, because everything he does will be conscious, intentional, and then he'll know when he makes a mistake, so he knows how to confess that. There are rules for confessing certain kinds of offenses and so on. Now, Buddhism, as you probably know, is, well, it's an Asian tradition, and so it's patriarchal. And the monks had 227 rules, and the nuns had 311. I didn't write the rules. Okay, so path of merit making. So by observing sila, taking the vow to observe sila, you earn a lot of merit. And another way you earn merit, in a very important way, is generosity. And that's called dana. It literally means giving. So generosity is intentional, right? When you want to give a gift to someone, it's because you have some intention to do so. And just as in sila, all else being equal, the merit that you get back from dana, from giving, being generous, is proportional to your intention. So if your intention is entirely altruistic, let's say you see a monk who you want to give to because you want to give to the religion, or you see a poor person and you want to give to them because they're poor and you feel pity, and you have no thought of satisfaction from this, that you're going to feel good about it or you're going to get merit. It's simply a spontaneous act of giving. That's the purest form, with no intention of reward or recompense for you. The second highest would be, and this is what most people do when they acts of donation, you know that you're going to get merit back. So that's a little less. You're still going to get a lot of merit back, but there's a little bit of selfishness there, right? Because you want to get something back. So that's not as pure. Another thing, you give something to somebody whom you love. Well, there's a great deal of investment there, and so you get less there. So the ideal donation is one that is impersonal and one that has no sense of retribution, positive retribution coming onto one. Now, another thing about dana and the amount of merit that you get back is that it is proportional, all else being equal, let's say your attention is all the same, on the virtuousness of the recipient. Not need, but the virtue of the recipient. So, giving to a puppy, you earn a lot of merit. Giving some food to a puppy. Giving food to a human being who happens to be a really bad person, a lot more merit, because he's a human being. There's a kind of hierarchy of being and biological order of Buddhism. Giving to a good person, more merit than giving to a bad person. Giving to a monk, more than giving to a lay person. Giving to a good monk, more than a bad monk, that sort of thing. People calculate that. Now, the highest possible donation is, let's say, even if the Buddha were alive, and you gave to him, he's the highest being in the universe. He's higher than all the gods and so on. So he would be the most meritorious being, so giving to him would be bring the greatest merit. But even donation to the Buddha is second to even a higher donation. And that is a donation to the Sangha as a community, as a congregation, with no intention of any individual within it receiving kind of special attention. But a generous donation to the Sangha. And why is that? In a certain sense, the Sangha is even more important for Buddhism than the Buddha. and why. When the Buddha attained enlightenment, he discovered the truth. When he discovered the truth, he became a Buddha. So you have a Buddha in the world. The truth he discovered is called the Dharma, and he established a Sangha to preserve his teachings after his demise for the welfare of the world, the welfare of living beings. So you have the Sangha, 1, 2, 3. So the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha are called the three jewels. When you assert that you are a Buddhist, you take refuge in the three jewels and so on. And the highest jewel turns out not to be the Buddha. I mean, if you come from a Christian tradition, that's kind of odd. That would be like elevating something above Jesus, right? But in this, it's the Sangha. It's the church, so to speak, that's higher than the founder. And that's because it preserves the teachings through time. Without the Sangha, there'd be no religion at all. And we would be left in darkness. We can't discover the truth ourselves. We have to rely on the discovery of a Buddha who discovers the Dharma, establishes a Sangha. Every Buddha who lives, all the infinite Buddhas in the past and all the infinite Buddhas in the future, will discover the truth, the Dharma, thereby becoming the Buddha, and will establish a Sangha that will preserve the teachings in the world for a time. But all things are impermanent, all things pass away, and the Buddha's Dharma, his teachings, and his Sangha will pass away just like he did. According to the Theravada, the Buddha's dispensation, his religion, will last 5,000 years. According to the Buddha's prediction, they find that in the commentaries. And we passed the halfway mark in 1954. So we're on the declining side. And from the time until when he established it, it was at its strength. And until at the end, it will finally disappear. It's going to be increasingly difficult to attain liberation as the religion declines, becomes corrupt and decrepit, because it must pass away too. And then it'll be millions and millions and billions of years until the next Buddha comes. So Buddhas, their dharmas, their sanghas are very rare things and precious things in the world. So Buddhists would always say that you're very lucky to be born at this time when the Buddha's religion is present, that you can use it either to attain happy rebirth or eventual liberation. So virtuous people and any recipient of donation is a field of merit. It's an agricultural metaphor. And it's by sowing your seeds of good deeds in a fertile field of merit that you get the best return. And so the highest field of merit in the world turns out not to be the Buddha, but the Sangha that he left behind. So long as there is a Sangha, you have this very fertile field of merit. Now, we also have this theory of the sharing of merit. So whenever you do a donation, there's a ceremony at the end where in Burma, different countries have different ceremonies, you'll have a beaker of water and a basin. And while you're reciting prayers that the monks, who are perhaps most likely the recipients of your donation, will recite and you'll repeat as you pour the water gradually into this basin until the whole prayer is recited. It's a very, very kind of beautiful prayer. And everyone around, you've invited all your friends and your relatives to witness your act of merit, because these things are typically done in public. They will rejoice in your meritorious deed. And they will share in the merit by doing that. Now, in Buddhism, you save yourself or you condemn yourself. It's a religion of self-reliance. So what is the sharing of merit stuff? How can you share in the merit? And also, the sharing of merit is for your deceased relatives. The idea is that perhaps your deceased relatives were reborn as ghosts. There's a species of rebirth called hungry ghost. And hungry ghosts like to hang around ceremonies like this. And by sharing your merit with them, they can attain liberation. They can attain at least escape from that woeful existence and maybe reborn as something better. So how does that work? Well, if you remember that karma is ultimately intention, an intentional action, it's a mental state. If you rejoice at the merit of somebody else, you get that same amount of merit. And if you share your merit with someone else, you're sharing something wonderful and beautiful, it redounds on you as well. So there's this like echo effect and redounding effect in the sharing of merit. So it fits in with Buddhist logic and Buddhist psychology that so long as you are with your mind intending something good, you get merit from that and good karma from that. That's how the sharing of merit logic works. Now, we talked about lay people donating to the religion. And the religion is the most fertile field of merit, whether it be monks or monasteries or pagodas and so on. These are all very fertile fields of merit. During the royal period, before 1885, Burma was conquered by the British in 1885, and its dynasties were extinguished at that time. Burma was a series of royal kingdoms, and the king was the chief layperson in the realm. He's the number one patron of the religion. He's a layman, he's inferior to monks and so on, but he has an army, he has jewels, he has might and so on, and he's supposed to be a righteous king. He's supposed to rule justly, not cruelly, but he's supposed to defend the people and the religion with warfare when necessary and so on. And when he gives donations, and he would always give the greatest donations, he would build the biggest pagodas. In fact, there were rules prohibiting others from building pagodas as big as the king because it would infringe on his majesty. He would be doing that on behalf of all of his citizens, whom he taxes. So everyone would participate in this. And he would hold grand festivals and so on at the pagodas he built and at the monasteries. He would sponsor monastic education and the copying of texts, which is a very laborious and expensive thing to do, all on behalf of all of his subjects. This type of meritorious action not only is soteriologically or salvationally significant, but it rains protection and beneficence over the realm. The rains will come on time, the seasons will be in order, there will be no famine, we'll not be invaded, there won't be pestilence or plagues if the king is doing his duty and being the chief patron on behalf of everyone. The Burmese kings took as their model a semi-legendary Indian king named Ashoka. Some of you probably have heard of Ashoka. Ashoka is known in Buddhist chronicles as a legendary, righteous Indian monarch who adopted Buddhism. He's also known from inscriptions. From inscriptions we also know, although the story is a bit different from his inscriptions, that he was a Buddhist convert. In any case, he is said to have built 84,000 pagodas and 84,000 monasteries as an example of his beneficence. And he asked the head of the Sangha, the chief abbot, "Am I not the greatest in the world because I've given so much? Am I not a kinsman of the Buddha? Am I not a kinsman of the religion?" And they said, "No, you're not. You've given more than anybody else in the world could ever possibly give because you're the biggest and the bestest and the richest of all kings. And so what you've done, you are a donor of requisites. That's good, but you're not a kinsman yet." She says, "How can I be a kinsman?" He says, "Because you haven't given the most precious thing." He says, "What is the most precious thing?" "You haven't given to the Buddha your son or daughter. That's how you become a kinsman of the Buddha. That's how you become a kinsman of the religion." And so at that point, Ashoka asked the crown prince and his daughter, "Won't you please take ordination and become monks and nuns?" And they did, and then the Sangha celebrated, "Ashoka, now you are a kinsman of the Buddha. Now you are a kinsman of the religion." And so the highest donation you can ever make is to donate your own son and own daughter to the Sangha to become members. What is more precious than your own son and daughter? And Ashoka's son and daughter became saints, became enlightened right away, and performed great deeds for the religion, and the king was greatly rewarded. Now let's turn our attention to the Sangha, to the monks and nuns themselves. Oh yeah, they take it for granted. Yeah, this is like overwhelmingly complex. All of these things, it's like a big machine. And for example, in the case of the king being the chief patron, and the whole kingdom participating in his acts of merit, the state is conceived of as a big merit-making machine, and the whole thing is for the generation of merit, and then for all the beneficence to flood over the land, right? So when we look at public expense, let's say in the medieval period when religious monuments were the chief way that states expended lots of money, it's also a way of redistributing wealth, because you are employing people to build the pagodas, you are conducting regular feasts that feed everyone, and you are employing lots of people, so the tax money that is going towards the state is going back out in terms of wages and salaries and so on. And what you do is you create an economy. For example, a university. Nothing could be a greater sinkhole in terms of money than a university, right? Just, what does it produce? People with degrees, right? However, it generates an entire economy around it. It can support an entire city. And it produces people who then go on and do great things, etc. So the massive expenditure on religion is an earlier version of what is still done by modern states, is taking resources, putting them into a central project, and then it not only recycles the money, but it generates economy around that. You know, in terms of the economy of merit, right? So that's how that works. I'm not defending it, I'm just sort of describing how a system like this could sustain itself over many, many centuries. Right? Now the Sangha, the monks who are the recipients of all this largesse, have obligations. They have to live by an austere code of conduct. They have to, through their observance of the monastic code, earn the merit that their parents are going to receive through their own observance of the rule. And what they give also is the high gift of Dhamma. They teach the Dhamma to other people, and that's considered the highest of gifts. In contemporary Burma, for a short period of time, well, I lived in monasteries when I was in Burma, and one of the things that I was impressed with is, first of all, in Asian society, they don't have, and in Burmese society in particular, they don't have the cult of privacy. So everyone is in everybody else's business, right? Kids are running in and out and so on and so forth. And the boundaries and the walls of the monasteries are very porous. The lay people are always in and out. And most people are poor, they're farmers and so on, and really save up a lot of money to give it to their monks and so on, some of whom might be their relatives or so on. And they really want a good return on their investment. And so they always check the monks, and their monks are always on display. The monks don't have any privacy, and the monks have to live by fairly rigid deportment of politeness, etiquette, being learned enough, and so on and so forth, kind. You cultivate a certain kind of charisma through training. You have to display that so that the laity who are supporting you are proud, and they know, oh, my generosity to the Sangha is helping the religion this much. And also, I'm getting a lot of merit back. What you see when monks are misbehaving, and they're just ordinary people, so they misbehave too, is lay people will chide them and will recommend, especially if they're young monks, little novices, they don't know what the rules are, the lay people will chide them, you know, Venerable Sir, you should do it this way, not that way, and wouldn't it be better if you did this and that? And then if a monk does anything very seriously wrong, then he is defrocked. Right? So even European observers, the Burmese, they may have been Christian missionaries and so on, hostile to the religion because it was a foreign religion or a pagan religion, etc. They pretty much universally said, we do respect the monks because they do, for the most part, really live up to the ideal as best they could. And the Burmese are very, very proud of that, you know. And so that's how that system is working. I said at the beginning of this section on merit-making how it's the most important societally. And what it is it connects the laity with the Sangha and other religious institutions, the state with the religious institutions, and people with one another in this reciprocal net of obligations, which keeps them on dedicated to the same overall purpose, happy when things go well. And so more than any of the other religious practices, which are more individual, this is like the cohesiveness and the glue that keeps the society together, and which really gave rise to Burmese civilization as we know it today. Now the second type of path to liberation is of insight meditation. And insight meditation is designed to calm the mind down and then allow the mind to perceive at a momentary basis the rising and passing away of phenomena. And typically what it does is focus initially on sensations, bodily sensations, such as putting concentration on the tip of your nose, and you feel the air go in the nose, you feel the air go out of the nose, or you feel sensations on your skin. And as you concentrate your mind, it's very much like when you become absorbed in reading a good book, time disappears, and you don't hear the outside world, and you're completely absorbed in this book. Or when you're doing a math problem, you're doing some research and you're utterly absorbed, everything else sort of disappears, you're not even aware of the passage of time. Well, you multiply that many, many times, and that's the kind of concentration that they seek to cultivate in this kind of meditation. And then you begin to see sensations very minutely. For example, the touch of the breath on the nose, you begin to see that there's many variations in that touch of the breath. Sensation will go here and there, and sometimes you'll notice a particular sensation sparks a memory, or a thought, or a daydream. So you're off daydreaming for a while, and then you become aware, oh, I'm thinking, I'm daydreaming. And then you note that you're daydreaming. You bring your mind back to the breath, if that's your object of meditation. Or you may have your mind as the object of meditation. You simply calm your mind, and you let your mind wander, except rather, instead of like daydreaming where you get absorbed and you relive the past relive what happened in the third grade, even though you're 80 years old and you remember all that and you're back there again. Instead, you see, oh, the mind is remembering that. And as soon as you objectify it and note it, you notice it disappears. And you'll be able to do that quicker and quicker and quicker and quicker and quicker and quicker and quicker. It's a relentless form of meditation, and it just sucks you into the object of meditation. And the idea is, their claim is, and the claim can't be verified because nirvana can't be objectively proved. It's a religious category. But the idea is that you will, at some point, when you've perfected that meditation, you can see the momentary arising, the impermanence of things, their suffering, the dukkha, insubstantiality of them, and the emptiness of and non-self of that phenomenon. And you extend that through the entire body, you extend that through all objects of meditation, and by doing that, then you attain detachment. And that's how you attain liberation. You see that there is, everything is impermanent, everything is suffering, everything is non-self, and then you become detached, and you become free. So it's an austere kind of meditation, and an austere kind of liberation. Now finally, the wizard, the waisado. Now the two types of religious practice that I described so far, practice of merit making and the practice of insight meditation, are considered orthodox. We find them described in the scriptures. And the path of the wizard is not. And path of the wizard is a combination of folk traditions from indigenous pre-Buddhist elements in Burma, and probably elements from North India, some elements from North Indian tantric Buddhism, and from China probably elements of Taoism, and so on. It uses as its techniques meditation, but not necessarily vipassana meditation. It uses types of meditation that are thought to deliver supernormal powers, but not liberation. So ability to fly through the air, to walk through walls, to read other people's minds, and so on. So these empowering meditations. And these meditations are considered to actuate a number of esoteric sciences that they train in, such as alchemy, such as the casting of runes and magical diagrams, the casting of mantras and magical spells. And the Waisa has as his goal not attaining his final rebirth, his final existence as an arhat and then passing out of samsara. He also doesn't want to get reborn again and again, go through the whole pain of life and death, being born, growing old, and dying again and again, so that in the future he can meet the future Buddha, Maitreya. That path of merit-making has its own risks, after all, because one of the things about karma is that you don't know your own karmic inheritance, because it's infinite, because you've been around for a long time. And you don't know when you're going to have to suffer some bad retribution for a long-forgotten misdeed performed in a previous life. This means that even good people can be reborn in hell, even though they lived a virtuous life this time, because of the ripening of a seed of demerit happened to happen. You know, so it causes a great deal of anxiety on the part of average Buddhists, because it's a reality for them. You never know. You can try your best. You can hope for the best through your meritorious acts, but you don't know whether you're going to have a happy rebirth or not because of past karma, which you can't see. And the wizard seeks to avoid that. He seeks never to die. If you don't die, you don't go through the rebirth process, which will bring a potential negative retribution into your next existence. Rather, he seeks to prolong his life until the coming of the next Buddha, to meet that next Buddha many billions and billions of eons from now in this very life, in this very diamond-like body. So the body is considered to be like diamond or like gold, which doesn't tarnish. And they use alchemy, mercury alchemy, other kinds of alchemy. And the metaphor is just as alchemy transforms base metals, which tarnish, into gold, which never tarnishes, so too these methods transform this corruptible body into something incorruptible and diamond-like or gold-like. So that is their path. They also consider themselves to be extraordinarily powerful and to act as defenders of the religion. So they'll use their magical powers to defend the religion against the forces of darkness, which are legion in their mythology. So these are the three paths of liberation. The last path, that of the wizard, because it's not attested in Scripture, it's sometimes criticized by the religious establishment as heretical. And also, because it seems to defy the Buddhist doctrine of impermanence, where everything is impermanent. Here you have a methodology which is prolonging life, and they'll say that the wizard is actually attached to existence. So he's addicted to self. The wizard will say, yeah, but I'm using my supernormal powers to protect the religion more than you can. So what are you talking about? And so the debate goes on between the wizard cults and the orthodox traditions. These three traditions today represent the salvation orientation of most Buddhists. The wizard tradition is a very small but significant peripheral tradition, somewhat secret. It's esoteric, you need initiation into it. The Vipassana movement, the insight meditation movement, is something that was revived. It's about 300 years old. For many, many centuries in the Theravada world, it was believed that the religion of the Buddha had declined too much for liberation to be possible in the present age. But about 300 years ago, in Upper Burma, a number of monks, they were scholar monks, went through the scriptures and said, no, there's nothing in the scriptures that really say this. So why don't we practice Vipassana and try to attain liberation in the present age? So there's a very interesting story with that, and I'll close with that little story. It turns out there's political connotations to the attainment of enlightenment. Remember I said that the king is the highest layman in the land? And of course he's inferior to monks. That's taken for granted in the Theravada scheme of things. He bows down to monks. He has the monopoly of force. He's like a Christian king who takes care of the church. The priests are above the king, and yet the king is all glorious. The monks are not a threat to him. But the king often portrayed himself as a future Buddha himself. I am striving to become a future Buddha in some far distant eon, long beyond Maitreya. And there happens to be a technicality in the Buddhology, the science of Buddhas in this tradition, that requires people who are seeking to become future Buddhas never to be enlightened until that moment in the future. That means the king is by definition an ordinary unenlightened person. And if that's the case, and that was the case about 300 years ago, the king at that time believed himself to be a future Buddha, and now at this present time I'm an extraordinary unenlightened person, there was a movement, a monk who said, people can become enlightened today. And his followers began to say, I'm enlightened, and wandering all over the kingdom. And so the king had that movement suppressed because it was sort of less majesty. It would mean that any slave, any peasant, any female who happened to get enlightened would be superior to his majesty, and he would have to bow down to them. And so he suppressed that movement. It was also at a time when the dynasty was in decline and the monarchy was pressured from all sides. So the very earliest record we have of the revival of insight meditation was unsuccessful. It was suppressed by the king. That king was the last king of his dynasty. The dynasty fell. That king was executed by his enemies. A new dynasty arose, the last dynasty before the British conquest. They had a very different attitude towards the practice of meditation. They actually patronized it. And so from that time on, insight meditation manuals in the vernacular began to be written. Those are the earliest evidences we have of insight meditation in Burma, and the earliest manuals that we have today. Insight meditation movement in Burma today, which is very, very popular, can trace its origins back to that initial founding, which turned out not to be successful. So with that, I will close and take any questions that you have.
Questions?
Yes.
Yeah, how many different versions of Buddha are there? Like Japanese and everything? Is this all the same? Or are
they... They're all different.
They're all different.
Yeah, they're all different. Yeah.
They're all called Buddhism?
They're all called Buddhism. Sometimes you'll find Zen tradition saying that it's not Buddhism, it's outside of Buddhism, it's part of its sort of self-identity. But they're all Buddhist, but they're all very different. So like in Burma and Thailand and these countries, for example, the notion of what a Buddha is different. It's a human being who discovered the path, established a religion to survive him, and then passed away. He's no longer available. But in China and Japan, Buddhas never pass away. They're more like deities. So they can continue to intervene in the world. They can continue to teach in the world through charismatic teachers who have dreams and in their meditations. And they can actually act as saviors to take you from the life of samsara, life of suffering, into their own Buddhist paradises. So in those, like the Chinese tradition, you have a whole new set of new paradises that are Buddhist paradises outside of samsara, where there is no suffering. So this is in forms of Buddhism that are a little bit later than the form of Buddhism that is preserved in Burma, which is a very archaic form. And liberation is not so austere in the Mahayana tradition. It's glorious. It doesn't require you to kind of disappear. There's basically eternal life, right? So that's what people normally want. So it's a very attractive religion in terms of its ultimate goals. I mentioned how comparison with St. Augustine, everyone will recognize Nirvana is the highest goal, and it's the highest good because the Buddha said so. But it's kind of austere, isn't it? And so let's put it off, you know? Oh Lord, make me chaste, but not quite yet, you know? That kind of thing. So you have both attitudes, yes.
How did you ever get into this field in Burma when the languages are so difficult? We're experiencing a difficulty here in my Bowling Green, and the difficulty is that they each speak a different dialect. How did you overcome that?
Took a long time of just training. So I began studying languages, let's say Burmese. Burmese was a difficult language for me to learn. It's very, very different from English. It's much more harder than the Indian languages that I learned, which are related to English. And so I took language classes, and then when I went to Burma the first time to do research, I was supposed to do my PhD research the first time, I couldn't speak or understand Burmese yet. So I just hung out, and I went to a monastery where the abbot spoke English, nobody else in the neighborhood spoke English. So I just began there with my grammars, and I asking people and starting to talk and making friends, and they would show me. And so learn that way, and then get formal training occasionally with the spoken language. And then with the formal literary language, once I had a sort of modicum of experience with the spoken language, I studied with scholar monks. Yeah. So, and then they trained me. It took a long time. Yeah.
Did you say at supper that you were dealing with some, I guess, English documents or documents that you're translating, or
at dinner tonight?
You're translating something else. What is that all about?
Oh, okay. So we were talking at dinner tonight. An interesting period in Asian history, just like an interesting period in world history, is Europe's initial expansion as a maritime power, right, all over the world, and into the New World, and simultaneously to Asia. Europeans, first the Portuguese, and then the Dutch, and the French, and the English, and the Spanish, and so on, wrote memoirs, often in Latin, if they were priests, if they were missionaries, about their encounters with these new peoples, either because they wanted to trade with them or convert them or conquer them and so on. So they're getting this kind of information. Well, there was this one monk, Christian priest, in the late 18th century who wrote the first European translation of a classic Burmese text. It was a Burmese chronicle written earlier that century. It was very, very renowned, which is probably why he chose to translate segments of it. So he translated that into Latin. And then he was there, he was allowed to live in Rangoon, which is near the coast, by the emperor at the time. Europeans were not allowed to penetrate into the country. But he was very knowledgeable. And then the British started showing up because they were taking interest in Burma as a place to conquer eventually. And so they contacted this priest, and he gave them all the information. He was a great guide for them. And one of the English bureaucrats, or civil servants, took his Latin translations of this Burmese chronicle and translated them in the Latin into English and published that. It was published in 1801. And it's the very first expose of Buddhist thought in English. And it's very, very good, because it's directly translated from this priest who translated it closely. Now, when I was in Burma, I saw the original English translation. I don't read Latin. So I compared the English translation with the text that I knew that it was ultimately translated from and compared them. I was able to identify it and said, you know, this is not bad. This is so much better than what professional Buddhist scholars were doing 75 years later, who were kind of mixing their own European ideas and imposing their own ideas on this material. And so this is the very, very earliest, and so that's what I was talking about. And what I would like to do is, with people who know Latin and people who are working in these various areas, it would be great to go into Portuguese archives and the Vatican archives to see if we can get those documents, and then compare them with whatever documents we can have from Burma or from other regions that we're in contact, and just to compare. We have a fair idea of how Europeans were looking at Asians or at other peoples they were encountering, but get a better idea of how the Asians, in this case the Burmese, were looking at these new people who were showing up in their strange boats and strange clothes and everything, and they have great guns, that's why we like them. Everything else we can, you know, keep away. So that's what I was talking about. So it would be really neat to see what this vision of the Europeans by the Burmese would be like.
Yeah, time for one more question. Someone?
Yes.
Is there a limit on the number of rebirths?
No, there's no limit. It's endless. You've already had an infinite number of rebirths because there's no beginning, there's no end. But you can get off by attaining liberation. Right? So that's the only thing that you haven't done yet.
Yeah. Well, maybe on that note, that might be a good time to call this to a close. Well, on behalf of WKU Friends Group, our cordial host here, Barnes & Noble, and you are a delightful audience. We want to thank you for coming out. Certainly one of the most interesting lectures we've had the pleasure to hear in many, many years. And we want to especially thank Dr. Prankey for coming down from Louisville, and wish you will join us. And when a visiting journalist from Samford University here will be talking about the Caldwell family and the Titanic in November. And thanks and good evening.